This is John Richardson. Today is January the 3rd, 2021. This is one more of my ongoing series of podcasts of things of interest to Americans abroad, green card holders, those seeking second citizenship, and those who realize the importance of global mobility in what's clearly a changing world. And today, my guest is somebody who, if anybody has interest in global mobility, has probably encountered his name. I'm referring to David Lesperance, who is a mobility advisor, helps people get second residences, second citizenships, create what he would call insurance policies in their lives for a variety of reasons. And of course, as I think we'll see, the COVID-19 situation has, I think, exacerbated that to some degree. I learned of David actually a couple of years ago, and to give a plug for his book right off the bat, I know you'll want to read it after our discussion anyway. It's called The Flight of the Golden Geese. The Flight of the Golden Geese, How the 1% Matter to the 99%. And last week I did a podcast with Mr. Hank Adler in California, and he was talking about people fleeing California, and what California's response to that is in part. So in that context, I welcome David Lesperance. How are you today, David?
Very well, thank you, John.
Okay. Well, you know, as I mentioned a minute ago, we could probably have a conversation for days and days and days, but I think a good starting point would be the book, The Flight of the Golden Geese. What's the general theme of that, the purpose of the book, and what were you trying to achieve?
Well, I co-authored the book with a London School of Economics professor emeritus named Ian Angel, who really was looking at the impact and flow of wealth between different countries. And as somebody who effectively moves what are called tax exiles, or wealthy people who are moving, it was very interesting to kind of talk with and see from Ian's point of view, the cumulative impact of a group of people, the golden geese we call them, that move. And one of the things we recognize was that whether you think it fair or not, a country which has a progressive tax system as its revenue model, by default, will rely to an extraordinary extent on a small number of people for a large amount of their revenue. And it varies from country to country, and it's actually exacerbated in the United States because there isn't a value-added tax that you have in countries like Canada or the UK. So they have an extraordinary reliance on personal taxation for a large chunk of their government revenue. And then you add on the fact that there is a reliance on what are called super contributors. And so we started to kind of think about, well, if you rely on a small number of people, let's have a look at those people. And are they sticky? Do they have choices? Can they move? Is there competition for them? And that's really what the book was about, was examining the kind of predictable themes of this increasing movement of the wealthy.
All right, well, that is fascinating. But you know, one thing you said that really strikes me as interesting is that it's interesting that the United States, because it does not have a value-added tax, has a higher reliance, if you will, on their wealthy. That's what you're saying, right?
Correct. So if you look at the pie charts of the percentage of different things such as excise duties, corporate tax, personal tax, payroll tax, which you could argue is a personal tax because it is relates to individuals. In countries such as Canada, basically all the other G9 countries except for the United States, you have a value-added tax, which is a increasing slice of that total revenue model. In the United States, you don't have that, and that slack is taken up by personal taxation, which increases, again, their dependence on personal taxation.
One would think that what you've articulated would be a very strong policy reason for the United States to move to a value-added tax, wouldn't you think?
Oh, I think there would be a lot of good reasons why a value-added tax would be in the United States revenue and government and citizens' best interests. Whether there is a political appetite to explain what a value-added tax is and to bring one in is another practical political consideration. I don't see it happening anytime particularly soon.
Okay. So what we have in the world that you and I live in, which is basically the world of first world democracies, we have progressive tax systems. We have very high tax rates, I think generally, that are going up. We have problems like COVID-19, which are making people aware that mobility is not necessarily a given anymore. We have growing and public investment migration industry, where there are all kinds of countries that are selling citizenship by investment or residence by investment, which means that we have a consciousness of and an appetite for people acquiring second citizenships and residences. And basically what you're doing is helping them achieve that, correct?
Correct. So if you're an American, and quite frankly, it's a relatively new phenomena for kind of native-born Americans to contemplate living outside of the United States. In fact, moving out of their locations in places like New York City or the Silicon Valley. COVID is, as Professor Scott Galloway would say, an accelerator that has accelerated. They left, you know, New York City during the early pandemic, and they went up to the Hamptons and then realized a body in motion can stay in motion. Why don't I move to Florida and reduce my state and city tax? Well, then they started saying, well, what if I move outside of the U.S. system completely and eliminate my federal tax and my estate tax, etc.? So that's been an increasing phenomena. And I look at how residents or citizenship or domicile impact taxation. They certainly don't want to jump out of the U.S. pot and into some other country's fire, tax fire. And a lot of countries, as you mentioned, are now in competition to try to attract the golden geese to their shores. So just as if you lose a relatively small number of golden geese, it'll have an asymmetric negative impact on your tax revenue. If you can attract foreign golden geese to your shores, they will add some tax revenue. They'll also add consumer spending, spending money on VAT, property values, employment, etc. So you've got traditional countries which have attracted foreign golden geese, like the United Kingdom under their non-dom or remittance basis. But you have new play, and Switzerland's another one with their lump sum forfait system. But you have new players such as Portugal and Italy and Greece, which are bringing in programs and specialized regimes, which are giving a more favorable tax regime to places where the golden geese are feeling pressed, that they are having an increased taxation and they can predict somebody's got to pay for all of this in COVID, that that's going to be them. And so they see in the future that their tax burden where they're at is not going to decrease, but actually increase.
Now, as I understand it, Portugal has an opportunity where, is it for the first some number of years, perhaps 10 years, to pay a reduced rate of taxation, is that correct?
Yeah, so they have something called the non-habitual residence tax regime, which you need to apply to the Ministry of Finance for it, but again, this group of clients will qualify for it, which gives you a 10-year holiday on your non-Portuguese source income. So if you have portfolio income or non-Portuguese, even if it's active business income, and you structure that appropriately, you can enjoy living in Portugal and not for 10 years paying Portuguese tax. During 5 of those years, you could naturalize. You could then take out Portuguese citizenship in the 6th year, and you will then, Portugal as an EU country, you could then move to any one of the other 26 countries or you can stay to the end of the 10th year. Again, depends on where you are in life, what your stickiness is, and what life inertia you built up. The advantage for Portugal is during that time that you are there, these individuals tend, I mean, Warren Buffett doesn't get up in the morning because he needs to cover the mortgage. They are people who tend to do business. So having those types of personalities in Portugal, some of them will start Portuguese businesses, which is great. But even if they don't, they're going to spend money and pay VAT tax. And they're kind of like the high-end tourists that every country spends so much money trying to attract.
Okay. And Italy has a similar sort of program?
Italy and Greece have introduced something called a lump sum, where it's 100,000 euros that you can choose to pay instead of. They've also brought in another new program, which has reduced rates of tax for certain type of digital workers, the so-called digital nomads. And the rate of tax that you have depends on where you're going. So they're trying to attract people to Southern Italy, Sicily, Naples, et cetera. And so they'll have lower taxes than, for example, a Milan or a Venice would have, lower tax rates. And Greece has a similar program.
Just in the last year, there have been three or four countries, speaking of the digital nomads and that, who basically just created programs for location-independent people. I think Estonia is one. Barbados, perhaps, another one.
Yeah, Barbados, Cayman. A number of countries have started to bring in those programs because they have lost their tourists. And so what they're doing is bringing in people who will rent hotel rooms, rent Airbnbs, go to
they're just
restaurants.
People will spend money there.
Exactly. So who that will reemploy all those people that used to deal with the 1 week or 2 week tourists.
Okay. This is all very interesting. One of the things that occurs to me is, let's take Portugal as an example, because I know somebody did this in Portugal, so it's easy for me to visualize. But part of the issue is, of course, so you move to Portugal and you become a tax resident of Portugal, but that does not in and of itself sever tax residency with, say, Canada, right?
So you have to look at what the rules are. So for Canada, you have two bases on which you are tax resident in Canada. One is a day count, sojourning, 183 days. The other is your centralized mode of living. And so Canada says that if you're going to leave Canada and you have to be out more than 6 months, you can't just get on a boat and sail in the open seas. You need to establish ties in another jurisdiction. So home, car, and that's actually encapsulated in a Revenue Canada form called NR73E, where you can kind of go through the list of items. And clients say, well, how do I know for sure I'm, you know, non-resident? And I use the analogy, it's kind of, when does soup become water? You take out major vegetables. Those would be, for example, a pied-à-terre, a home available to you in Canada, a spouse, children in Canada. Those would be major vegetables. Then you look at secondary issues, medical services. Are you storing sporting equipment, club memberships, et cetera? It's all articulated in that Revenue Canada form. But Revenue Canada, in order to become non-resident in Canada, you need to go to another jurisdiction. The other advantage, and one of the things that we look a lot at, are moving from Canada, for example, and wanting to move to a country that Canada has a tax treaty with, because then we can look at the tiebreaker rules under the tax treaty. So okay. That's so, yeah, one of the reasons we look at those countries.
I think that's such an important point for listeners. So up until now, when you talk about tax residency in Canada, you talk about the statutory day test, 180 183 days, or what we'll call the center of gravity. Those are ways to determine under Canadian law whether you're a tax resident or not. When we move to treaties, okay, they assume, the tax treaty tiebreaker would assume that you were a tax resident of Canada and of the treaty partner country, and the treaty would then operate assuming tax residence in each country. Which of the two countries would you be assigned tax residency to, right?
Correct. I always think of tax treaties are kind of the Queensbury rules when two countries are fighting over you. And you look at the OECD standard and you go through a list of them, and it kind of determines who's going to get the actual tax and who's going to get a foreign tax credit potentially on their return. And that's really how to look at it. But it's interesting to contrast, the United States doesn't have a requirement that you establish a foreign tax residence. Their definition of a U.S. person for tax purposes are that you are a citizen, a resident alien, or their own version of a day count, which is called the substantial presence test.
Or to put it another way, if you're a U.S. citizen, if you're a U.S. citizen, there's no way to sever tax residence with the United States.
Well, correct. So you have to get rid of
renunciation.
You have to renounce. You have to relinquish your resident alien / green card status. And you have to make sure that you don't spend too many days physically present in the United States.
Right. But a green card holder could use a tax treaty tiebreaker provision, whereas a citizen cannot.
Correct. Well, it's going to be, yes, that's correct, to sever that tax residence. I just had an interesting conversation with a gentleman who's contemplating it. And in his case, he's relinquishing a long-term green card. So he's what is called a covered expatriate. And we were talking about future tax homes, and he's single, which is an advantage of mobility. He also, cycles and skis. And he says, well, I don't really anticipate spending more than 4 months of the year anywhere. And so we were talking about different jurisdictions, and he came to the realization, well, I'm going to leave my U.S. tax status. Where am I going to, what's going to be my new tax status? And I said, well, unless you're going to centralize or sojourn, which are the normal rules, for example, in other countries, you may not have one.
Imagine that. Cycling around the world and skiing without being a tax resident of any country. How cool is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, that's not something that I became a non-resident in Canada for tax purposes. So I went through that, but I'm in a different situation. I'm married. I have two small children. So when you put together what I call backup plans, they not only have to make financial sense, in other words, sell them at the boardroom table, but you've got to be able to sell them at the breakfast table. If your family isn't able to live the plan, then you might as well put it under glass. So you have to come up with a plan that is livable. I mean, if you say to your family, well, everybody's going to move to Pitcairn Island, it'll work wonderfully from tax point of view, people aren't going to do it. And occasionally I'll have a client that said, well, I've just been sued or audited, move me to a rock in the middle of the ocean. And I'll say, no problem, but make sure you pack a gun. Well, why? Well, within 6 months, either you're going to want to kill yourself or your family's going to want to kill you. They say, oh, no, I need schools for the kids. I need access to airports. I need this kind of, what are requirements or preferences in their lives. And it's really putting together, you mentioned earlier, insurance policies of an alternative citizenship. Americans need that because of citizenship-based taxation, an alternative residence. Because if you're not going to be sleeping in Canada or the U.S., you need to be sleeping somewhere else. If you're 40-something and you don't have anybody to answer to at the breakfast table, then you can spend 4 months of the year in Switzerland, 4 months in New Zealand, and 4 months in Portugal, and life is good. If you're somebody like me with young children post-COVID, you're going to probably be somewhere 9 odd months of the year as the kids go to school.
So looking at this from the American perspective, as long as they're U.S. citizens, they cannot sever tax residency with the United States. Presumably, the first step would be to consider where they can get a second citizenship, correct?
Correct. So when we look at that, for the Americans, the what I call fire insurance is an alternative citizenship and an alternative residence. And sometimes the citizenship may give that residence, sometimes not. They may have that citizenship from birth. Either they moved to the United States and became naturalized, or they had a U.S. citizenship because of a foreign parent. They may have claim to a citizenship through lineage, the United States and Canada, in fact, all of the Americas were immigration destination countries in the 19th and 20th centuries. And so there may be a claim to a citizenship in, quote unquote, the old country. They may have claim to a citizenship through religious ties. For example, the Israeli law of return, they can make aliyah and get an Israeli citizenship. They may have enough time, depending on the situation, to get residence or junior membership in another country and become naturalized after whatever the naturalization period, 3, 5, 7 years in that foreign country is. And the last thing we look at, if all of those are not available, is we look at whether it makes sense for them to consider a citizenship by investment. And citizenship by investments are countries which have said, in lieu of a naturalization period, we're going to require government fees and or some type of investment in a business or a real estate in our jurisdiction. And there's a number of different jurisdictions that have this. And one of the key points that I always make to clients is I get paid by the client. I don't get paid referral fees from some project in a citizenship by investment country. So that way they understand that the advice that is being given is not driven by my desire to have a high commission, but rather by what I think is in their best interest.
Right. You know, on that note, I should have asked you this at the beginning of the podcast, but perhaps for listeners, can you describe a little more about you and what it is you do and that sort of thing?
Sure. Canadian. My family has their roots several hundred years back in Canada. I grew up in Windsor, border city, and what was quite common back then, have half of my family are dual citizens. My father would wake up in Canada, work in the United States. Again, quite common in border cities like Windsor. Going through law school, I needed a summer job. My father got me a job working at the Windsor-Detroit Tunnel. I used to see the immigration people with their feet up reading the newspaper and thought, that's the job for me. And then we moved to Toronto and I did the same job at Terminal One, the old Terminal One at Pearson. And then it was just a great gig going through school. And then I either saw the light or went to the dark side and got called and started working. And have now kind of what I do is either immigration savvy tax advisor, tax savvy immigration advisor, and work with tax lawyers and try to, at a strategy level, try to figure out what backup plan will work for a particular client that they're either going to use, what insurance, the analogy we're using of alternative citizenships or residences. And I do that in coordination with a number of people. So for example, if a Portuguese golden visa residence by investment is required, we would I would determine, you know, which jurisdiction worked, and then the client would, you know, we would retain local Portuguese counsel. There's, you know, if it's an expatriation consideration, there'd be specialized tax counsel. I certainly don't manage money. I don't know. I'm not a foreign exchange trader. I just understand how all those pieces fit together. And I like using the analogy that the tax lawyers write the symphony and direct the orchestra, and I play first violin.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How did you get interested in this?
If you look at my background, it sounds quite Machiavellian, but it isn't. I needed the job, and I got tired of asking people where they were going, and the immigration job looked good. And then I was originally, when I came out, I thought I was going to do international corporate law, and then hit a recession. And as they do at firms, they ask, what else can you do? And I said, well, I kind of know this stuff I grew up with at the breakfast table, and started doing that, and was lucky enough in time, that was before the 97 handover in Hong Kong. So I did a lot of three decades now of clients in that area. I helped my first client do an expatriation again in 1990. I was kind of running up and down the Gulf. If this is Tuesday, must be Doha, before, during, and after the Gulf War. And I found it fascinating because, especially when you're dealing with lineage citizenships, you have to understand the history of Europe, the history of immigration, and, you know, how all these things interplay, and different countries' laws. It's a very interesting area. You know, I always say, you know, I got into being a tax advisor because I didn't have the personality to be an accountant. But to me, I find it interesting. And it's really, you're looking at it on the global stage, and you really have to know it, to really be able to service, you have to kind of understand what's happening, you know, in the world. So you're not just reading a local newspaper, you know, you actually read The Economist and a number of other publications.
Well, David, this has been an incredibly interesting discussion up until now. I'd like you to apply some of this to the situation in Canada. And I would also like to continue the podcast specifically with the topic of the Canadian situation. So thank you very much. And let's pick this up again a bit later.